Hello and welcome to the Joint Venture Podcast, Inspiration Insights. I'm joined today by our senior analyst, Dila.
Hi Oliver, glad to be back.
And by our reporter, Ashkenaz.
Hi Oliver.
So what have we got for you today? Well, we've got plenty of news and quite a lot of analysis about what's been going on in various bits of Europe. We've got a particular focus on Poland we're going to get to throughout the news and later. And this is going to touch on net zero policy, on the move towards net zero and the implementation of these policies. I think Dila's going to give us a bit of a roundup on many of these issues in the EU in particular. Look forward to that later.
Sure will. Yeah, some policy struggles have been underway.
First, we will go to the news as usual. Ash, what do you have for us?
Inspiratia were the first to report last week that the 1.14 gigawatt Baltic Power offshore wind farm in Poland reached financial close, securing 3.6 billion euros in commitment. When finalized, the project will be the first offshore wind farm in Poland to be financed and progressed to the construction phase. The developers, Northland Power and Orlen, have secured 80% of the project cost as debt and a portion of it in the form of non-recourse green financing.
So what do we know about this financial close?
The debt package was arranged by a group of 25 lenders along with export credit agencies and the European Bank of Reconstruction and Development and also the European Investment Bank. Northland's share of equity was fully secured through the green hybrid bond issuance in June 2023 and existing corporate liquidity. The developers expect the construction of the project to commence as early as 2024, with delivery expected before the end of 2026. Later in the week, we also revealed the list of 25 lenders, which you can find on Inspiratia's website.
Yes, there's plenty more details we've got about the breakdown of that financing, which, as you mentioned, can be found online.
In more news, Danish utility Ørsted has joined forces with the UK developer PS Renewables to pursue the development of a 750 megawatt solar farm in England. The project, known as One Earth Solar Farm, also includes an associated battery energy storage system of a yet-to-be-specified capacity and marks Ørsted's entry into the UK solar sector. The developers are considering both a CFD scheme and a corporate PPA model for the output of the solar farm. Progressing on the current timeline, the solar farm should be fully operational by 2030. Now, due to its size, the project is set to be classified as a nationally significant infrastructure project. These are major infrastructure development projects in England and Wales that bypass normal local planning requirements. And these projects have to be given planning permission via development consent order. These large-scale projects fall into five general categories, which are energy, transport, water, wastewater, and waste. However, over the past few years, the consenting process has slowed significantly in recent years amid a rise in the number and complexity of cases that are coming into the NSIP planning system. This is why in February this year, the UK government published plans to overhaul the planning process for these projects. The government is currently consulting on these plans to speed up the permitting process, which also includes offshore wind schemes in England and Wales. And in another exclusive for Inspiratia, Swedish energy company Ellevio acquired Markbygden Nät, an onshore wind transmission network. The network connects one of Europe's largest wind farm clusters, the Markbygden 1101, located in northern Sweden, to the country's national grid. The network was previously owned by Swedish developer Svevind and the German wind turbine manufacturer Enercon, and now Ellevio is the sole owner of the company. Sweden's largest electricity supply grid connection point, the Rabäcken substation, and the connected infrastructure to the wind farm cluster are among the major assets included in this transaction. Ellevio will operate the subsection together with the Swedish national grid provider. Now, in more news from Poland, the joint venture of utilities Equinor and Polenergia has locked process on its MFW Baltic 1 offshore wind farm in Polish waters with final environmental consent expected in H1 2024. The wind farm will have an estimated capacity of 1.5 gigawatts and is part of the Baltic offshore wind cluster, which also includes the 720 megawatt Baltic 2 and the 720 megawatt Baltic 3. All three projects were initially developed by the Polish utility Polenergia, which sold 50% stake of its development rights to Equinor in 2018. The joint venture is progressing with the development of Baltic 2 and Baltic 3, ahead of Baltic 1, with plans to have the 1.4 gigawatt capacity fully operational by the end of 2027.
This is a really interesting one that comes after the financial close on Baltic Power. to be clear, Baltic Power is separate from Baltic 1, 2 and 3, spelt slightly differently. But I think that the big advancement that Baltic Power has gone through in the last week in reaching that financial close for its 1.14 gigawatt plant. That must be giving a lot of heart to other developers in the Baltic region and operating within Poland. Yeah, as this one comes in as a slightly larger one, 1.5 gigawatt. So I think we very well might start to see some of the future projects ramp up that ambition in that region.
I guess Baltic Power is the first project to be built, first offshore wind project to be built in Poland, but it seems like there are going to be a lot more to come.
Yes, and this will reflect on the strength of the Polish auction process, which is fairly new, but you know, it certainly seemed to be relatively successful in delivering Baltic Power, at least. So yeah, moving forward, it's going to be a really interesting space. I imagine the next Polish auctions will be much more competitive.
Novtórsol Energies has raised 77 million euros to help fund 175 new photovoltaic projects in France. The financing was arranged in the form of debt and equity. Our news reporter Aishwarya was able to get the entire financing breakdown in this portfolio, which you can find on our website. The total debt package was put together by three banks, with Energeco acting as the lead arranger. These projects are in construction stage and are scheduled to be commissioned by 2024. This transaction is in line with Duracell's target of operating 1,000 plants by 2028. And finally, just earlier this week, the Irish government published its provisional auction results under the country's third onshore renewable energy support scheme. The auction, managed by state-owned utility Airgrid, was undersubscribed, with just over 600 megawatt capacity securing offtake under the approximate target of 2 gigawatts. A total of 23 projects with a combined capacity of 646 megawatts was provisionally awarded offtake guarantees at a strike price of 100.47 euros per megawatt hour. Now, the auction primarily awarded projects to solar, which was nearly 500 megawatt of capacity, with onshore wind being awarded 148.4 megawatt capacity.
Yes, this was an interesting one because, as you say, it was undersubscribed, I think, comparing to the initial targets of the auction. Because looking into this one, the award structure, they seem to be going off the contracted volume sold, so the gigawatt hour rating rather than the megawatt. So the amount awarded, I think, amounts to just over 900 gigawatt hours over the course of the contracts, which is within what they stated as the range of the auctions, which I think was from about 500 to 1,500 gigawatt hours. However, there were reports from before the awards were announced where figures much higher than that were reported in the sort of 2,000 to 3,000 gigawatt hour range. So it certainly seems like there's been a collapse in ambition, perhaps as a response to some of the undersubscribed auctions that we've seen earlier this year already. Thank you so much for the news roundup, Ash.
Thank you, Oliver.
So, Dila, in the last week, you've been doing a lot of more research as usual. And this time, there's been a lot of news from solar capacity and some problems with solar manufacturers in Europe. Can you tell us more?
Yes. So over the last few months, the solar industry across Europe has been sort of experiencing an up and down journey, really. It's performed quite well, actually. But over the last few weeks, there has been a warning letter issued from Solar Power Europe to the European Commission that has been warning about potential insolvencies across the industry, which has sparked concerns towards the continent's achievement of its net zero goals. That's been quite dramatic news, really. And it's been mainly attributed to the sort of massive influx of cheap Chinese imports. Yeah, and there's been calls for the Commission and the EU at large sort of to step in and remedy some of these imbalances that are at play.
I can see why that's such a big problem for the industry. But this comes after what has been considered quite a good year for solar.
Yeah, definitely. So it's been, again, it's been sort of up and down. And sort of the up story of that journey is the continent is actually projected to install 475 gigawatts of solar power by the end of the decade, which means it will have doubled its current installed capacity by then. Just to put it into context as well, in 2022 alone, last year, Europe saw an addition of 41 gigawatts, which is a 40% year-on-year increase from 2021. And for this year, 2023, it is expected to rise over 50 gigawatts. So it's actually a massive rollout of solar power and actually really positive development. This has also been spurred by the European Union's Net Zero Industry Act, where they've been trying to achieve a goal of reshoring 30 gigawatts of the solar PV supply chain. So a lot of manufacturing capacity has been sort of set up for local production of green technologies. But now this sort of Chinese influx again of those panels has been putting many of these companies at risk of bankruptcy.
So how does that installed capacity per year figure compare to how much coming from Europe versus coming from China?
The global manufacturing growth has been mainly driven by China and the EU, which together they've accounted for 85% of the growth in annual PV capacity additions. So quite a large chunk of it. However, I think it's important to note here, and also in response to your question, European solar imports from China have outpaced newly installed capacity in 2022. So Europe itself installed 41 gigawatts, but it also imported the equivalent of 80 gigawatts from China. So there's an extreme sort of imbalance and an exposure, and also a dependence on what the continent is increasingly also coming to recognize as a rival economy.
So no wonder the prices have come down so much if there's Chinese produce sitting waiting for install that's already been produced.
Yeah, correct. So there's been a collapse of 25% of the prices of PV modules since the start of this year, falling to less than 0.15 cents per watt. So selling these products has become increasingly difficult. And again, it's just led to this broad and sweeping risk of insolvencies within the sector as their stock sits there and devalues.
That's right. I've got some figures in front of me from PV Exchange and Solar Power Europe. And yeah, high efficiency panels since the beginning of year, down in price by 9 cents per watt. Mainstream panels down by 8 cents per watt. It's just, you can really see why these companies are feeling that pressure.
Yeah, exactly. And that's mainly, again, and, you know, not to sort of lean too heavily on China, but it is sort of the main culprit of this sort of breakdown of prices within Europe. And that's mainly also attributed to the way China has set up its manufacturing capacity. It's just a lot more agile and reactive in terms of how it is operating its supply chains. So setting up manufacturing for the capacities of polysilicon ingot and wafer module takes a lot longer in Europe, and it's surrounded by a lot more uncertainty than it is in China, where they sort of just get on with it. So there is a lot less regulatory barriers than there are in Europe. And also, one of the other reasons they're a lot slower is because there are obviously a lot stronger adherences to rigorous standards for wages of workers, the working hours, whereas these sorts of elements remain rather opaque within China. So again, there the agility comes into play. So they have a lot more wiggle room and flexibility in terms of how they're responding and reacting to market demands. And resulting from that, they just are able to create a lot more supply for increasing demand.
So you mentioned at the start there was this letter published by Solar Power Europe to the European Commission. What kind of measures are they calling for? What can help with this situation?
One of the main things that can also address the supply chain issues I've mentioned is the introduction of non-price criteria as a measure to sort of level the playing field and also allow European players to sort of highlight their strength and operational sort of integrity within this manufacturing race.
So this is non-price criteria into auction and tender and approval processes to incentivize onshoring.
Exactly, correct. Yeah. What the letter itself, however, has called for is that there is an emergency procurement of the module stocks from the European PV manufacturers. They also would like to see the establishment of an EU-level solar PV manufacturers bank in order to tackle the state aid concerns within the temporary transition crisis framework. That then is also coupled with the integration of rigorous sustainability and resilience non-price parameters into specific auctions. Yeah, so the EU itself has obviously recognized this issue, and it also coincided with a few developments within sort of the EU legislation cycle. The EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen gave her State of the Union speech in which she mentioned the negative fallout from China's trading practices. The bloc has also approved to raise its renewable energy target to 42.5% by 2030 instead of 30%, as this push for clean and sustainable energy intensifies. And this is also thought to sort of create the urgency around supporting the solar industry. The EU Parliament has also approved plans to bolster its critical raw materials supply, as it is seeking to sort of reduce its dependence on China. And this will be quite important because it is looking to diversify its supplies of these very important raw materials that are integral to the manufacturing of some of these products. And here the ultimate target is also not to rely on a single country for more than 65% of its supply for any strategic raw material by 2030. So quite ambitious plans here, but I think it'll be important for the EU to continue to recognize this issue and find a way to level the playing field. But I think it's also important that a thoughtful strategy is being put into place that doesn't create the sort of long-term dependence on subsidies as well. So there's a lot of work to be done still within the EU, but this is a rather urgent issue that does need to be addressed quite soon.
Thank you very much, Dina.
Thank you, Oliver.
So in the past week, we have been recoiling from the fallout in the UK of Rishi Sunak, Prime Minister's latest net zero commitment changes. So, brief outline on this before we get into it. The UK has a formal, enshrined in law, target to achieve net zero by 2050. And along the way to this, there are various targets which the government has set itself to get there. Some of those targets were coming up quite soon, in 7 years. On 2030, that was the cutoff date for several of the key targets. So this included no new internal combustion engine cars being able to be sold, and also a cutoff point to new gas and oil boilers being sold. Now, in the last week, Sunak has announced that the government are rolling those dates back. In the main, he's giving a lot more time to consumers in the industry by about 5 years. So 2035 is now the cutoff for those things. But of course, this has been seen as quite a political point to what were quite ambitious targets, welcomed by some parts of the industry, very sceptical voices from many others. Guys, what did we think about the change in policy?
Well, I think the point you make about it being quite political, I think, is quite correct. There is a quite generous reading of these targets weren't very realistic potentially, which is probably correct. I think we did a story not too long ago how the EV infrastructure is not anywhere close to where it needs to be, which is correct. But then that's a quite different admission to, oh, we don't want to overburden the consumer. The role of a government here would have been to, yes, you do set these targets not to be pushed back continuously, but to be reached and then to support the consumer and industry in achieving them. And to sort of just spin the story around and say, oh, we're actually on the side of the consumer and we haven't taken the necessary steps in order to get there, I think is misleading. To say that these pushed back dates won't be standing in the way in achieving net zero by 2050 is borderline nonsense, I would say, particularly considering that recent reports have pointed out that on its current track, without those dates having been pushed back before, just recently, that the UK wasn't on track and weren't sort of showing the confidence people need. In light of all of that, I don't see how the net zero target would remain in place, actually. So I think that's, I'm sure the government will come up with some sort of fact sheet.
Well, to play the role of the government spokesperson for a second,
let's entertain
that. So Sunak argued that the UK has already been doing very well in achieving its net zero targets, with emissions coming down by about 50% since 1990 levels, and that in overachieving on some of its previous targets, he says the UK can afford to perhaps appropriately take its foot off the gas a bit in this regard. Mm. So that could be one view. It seems that you're quite skeptical about that.
Yeah, I'm very skeptical of that, actually, because to say, oh, we've done our bit, let's let the others catch up, I mean, absolutely illogical.
It does speak to a sort of a slight abandoning of the responsibility.
Yeah.
You kept bringing up that the UK's total emissions amount to about 1% of current emissions, which, you know, is true. But at the same time, the push towards net zero has to be a global one.
Exactly. And I think if you look at sort of historical emissions, remind me where the Industrial Revolution started? Just a quick reminder. What's the responsibility here then? I mean, yes, if it kicked off here, maybe the energy transition should also kick off here and maybe show some leadership, continued leadership, to just sort of back out of this because it's convenient politically. It doesn't make any sense. And you're not only letting industry hanging, but also the consumers pushing back these targets. This target about EVs would have been coming into place in 7 years. Now it's 12 years. That's quite a drastic change for people who were about to buy one, about to commit this rather, yes, still pricey purchase. That's quite a pushback. I can see loads of people just not committing to this because
I think
the government
right.
isn't.
Yeah, I think the consumer behavior is where this is really going to show its effects. We've seen quite a few car companies setting up shop in the UK recently.
Yeah. Tata Group was in Somerset, and the BMW setting up its mini production facilities for EVs would have been in Oxford, I think.
Yeah, so BMW, for example, have made the independent commitment that all of their fleets will be net zero by 2030. Now, if the government is not sticking by its own pledges, then maybe that will have a knock-on effect on car companies saying, okay, well, maybe BMW will say, maybe we can keep our old plant running for longer than we thought, and, you know, the compounding effect could be quite large over the course of what remains of this half of the century. Because if we are sticking to that final net zero by 2050 target, then all pushing the initial date backwards does is mean that the transition on the other side of the date is going to be even steeper.
Exactly.
So it could be just seen as delaying the pain now for pain later rather than a gradual transition.
And that's a really good point about investment from car companies, because if you look at broader investment in general, seeing that the UK government is pushing back its own targets shows a lack of commitment. And so what is stopping, well, not just car companies, just general investors just looking at Ireland or looking at the EU instead of the UK?
Yeah, Tata Group was also looking to invest in Spain, which, you know, compared to the UK, UK's ambitious targets was probably not as strong. But then this just sends a completely wrong market signal to the entire industry. So I think in that sense, also abandoning a leadership role, when you're ahead, you stay ahead, surely.
And to be clear, this what we're referring to here is £4 billion investment that Tata Group is planning to make in a UK gigafactory to produce electric car batteries, which was actually confirmed earlier in this year with huge subsidies from the UK government.
And it's also considered one of the biggest investments in the automotive sector. So yeah, there's sort of, I think the thing we've been hearing since these announcements actually is that the three things sort of the industry needs is commitment, urgency and predictability. And all of that has been weakened at the very least.
This week, we also saw in the London Excel Centre the 2023 London Climate Technology Show. Ash and I both attended. Ash, what did you think?
It was quite an interesting event. There was a lot of focus on the carbon credits market because there were so many different companies, and that's a very software focused event. But in terms of renewable energy, there were a couple of companies that I was really interested in.
Yes, you mentioned that you saw someone about pumped hydro.
Yes, there are developments in the pumped hydro space. So there's a company called Re-Energize that is developing a pumped hydro model that uses a proprietary high-density fluid that is 2.5 times thicker than water. And the benefits of that is that they can build much smaller projects. They don't need big reservoirs. They can use smaller hills, smaller tanks, and that significantly cuts down the cost of building a hydro project, which they say is one of the biggest challenges of developing hydro project, the sheer cost of building the dam, building the entire structure. And because because it's a thicker fluid, it generates a lot more electricity than just plain water. And I think the largest projects that can be built from that are around 10 to 50 megawatts. And the idea is to have smaller projects, but built in hills all around the country. And that will help balance the grid and can be co-located with renewable energy projects.
Yes. And there was also, I think, I don't know if you saw this too, but there seemed to be a lot of focus on biomass projects. I think particularly what you mentioned about the carbon trading sector is important here too, because one area where this kind of tech and energy sector overlap is really starting to happen, I think, is in these carbon credits. You've got these various schemes for carbon trading happening across the world at the moment. And something like a biomass plant, where, you know, the business model has been relatively simple in the past, suddenly if you hook that project into a global carbon trading market and you're making moves which in your operations take carbon out of the atmosphere, that opens the door to like extra revenue streams. You're able to trade with partners. And I think the kind of movement on that seems to be quite hot at the moment. I know that carbon trading has been happening for a while, but it certainly seems like people are getting renewed excitement about this with some of the more complex schemes coming down the road.
But I think carbon credits are also particularly useful for groups like Nature Reserves, because they can leverage the fact that they're managing such large projects. And that might be outside our typical energy and infrastructure remit, but having large nature reserves, leveraging them, they can generate carbon credits and basically giving them an additional source of revenue.
Yeah, I also got to talk to some of the interesting representatives from Resist, which is one of the groups that are being funded by the European Commission to operate a number of development sites around the EU. I thought it was quite interesting that they're at a London event, because they're really looking for those kind of innovative climate solutions to bring to their sites all across Europe. So that was a really interesting conversation I had there. And also, I think that there was quite a focus on EV charging and fleet management, which I didn't quite expect to see. But we spoke to people at Michelin Scotland Innovation Park, for example, where they're hosting multiple new solutions to EV charging tech. For example, not just using static infrastructure for EV charging, but if you think of a future where there's going to be sort of a lot of temporary events, that you need to have movable infrastructure for that. There was also on the sort of fleet management and charging software side, some companies who are managing the sustainability of large fleets like those operated by Amazon and Uber around the world. They're trying to move into the London sector and get involved in so many of the transport solutions which are cropping up around the gig economy. So there's a lot of opportunities here for people like that to come in and help reduce the carbon footprint of these companies, and then that then feeds back into the whole carbon trading, carbon accounting thing. So there's a lot of interesting stuff going on in the space outside of what we normally talk about, which is the pure infrastructure sector, but I think that's worth keeping an eye on. And if people are interested in that, we can certainly dive more into that side of the sector in the future. Thank you once again for listening to this episode of the Joint Venture Podcast, and I'd like to thank our contributors today. Thank you so much, Dila.
Thank you, Oliver.
And thank you, Ash.
Thank you, Oliver.
We will be back with more news and analysis very soon. But until then, goodbye.
Ciao.
Bye-bye.